Today, is the alleged mental health crisis real? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ashley Frawley from Swansea University. Hello, Ashley.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today. And one of the things that I think is a really interesting conversation to explore at the moment is the way that suddenly mental health has got connected with COVID. Right. I did a quick count up in the last week here. There have been nearly 40 articles, all of whom are linking directly COVID to mental health. And yeah. I, as a sociologist, what do you make of that?
I mean, it's not really surprising. There is a tendency, there's long been a tendency for the sort of therapeutic entrepreneurs to exploit disasters and crises around the world, and you can see actually sometimes in disaster situations after a natural disaster, there'll be huge claims being made that people in that part of the world will need enormous psychological intervention to overcome PTSD and things like that, and it has happened that people are offered psychological help before they're offered the things that they are actually demanding, which is, contact. They want to trace their family members. They need shelter, food, that kind of thing. And yet this army of psychological professionals comes over. And there are also some very dubious results of these kinds of interventions, because certainly in many Western countries, we have a decline of tradition and a certain amount of individualization. So we are less connected to people around us. And, we have the old confessional, the priest that we would go to and sort of dump out all of our sins and our worries to has sort of declined. And so the professionals of everyday life have sort of filled that space. But in these other contexts, that's not necessarily the case. And what can happen is that those existing ways of coping, existing contacts, existing, coping relationships that people have can be undermined by this idea that actually this requires professional intervention and specialized expertise. And so there's been a lot of sociological literature that's examined that. So it's not surprising at all that you would have this sort of therapeutic entrepreneurs exploiting COVID-19.
Right. So if I try and unpack that a little, we have essentially a set of social issues, and those could be, the issues of not meeting people and those sorts of things, or more broadly, things like homelessness or those other issues, those social issues. But often the solution is not to deal with the social issues themselves, but essentially to treat a symptom with a medical response. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that people don't try to deal with the material side of things, but I've noticed that as the material side of a situation, for instance, poverty or persistent inequality, becomes more or less a perennial kind of issue, very difficult to deal with, we start to see a kind of dematerialization of those issues. They stop being about that material side, and it becomes more about the psychological effects. It becomes very difficult, for example, to talk about just unemployment without turning it into a health issue. Why is unemployment bad? Because it's bad for mental health. Well, is it not bad enough to not be able to feed your children, to be, to be confined for like a decade to the lack of freedom that not having a proper job gives you? Isn't that bad enough without having to turn it into a health problem? And when you turn it into a health problem, it invites a health solution, right? A medical solution. So to be very careful how you define an issue. And I've noticed that as other goals for society have declined, as we've kind of lost the sense that the future could be materially better than today, or that it should be materially better than today, there's been this space has opened up for this kind of psychologization of issues, medicalization of issues. Okay, yeah, inequality, we've tried to deal with it. It's very difficult to deal with. We know we need to deal with it in some way. But really, is this not essentially a problem of mental health. And what the real problem is the mental health supports that people are not able to access. And that is an actual literal claim that I have actually seen. You can, I was on this show for the BBC, The Big Questions, and this woman in the audience asked, you know, well, this is all well and good, you know, all this, you know, talking about psychology and so on, but we in the Welsh Valleys don't have jobs. And, you know, the people on the panel did this sort of hand-waving move, and at the end they were like, well, what we're really talking about is mental health. And the woman was sort of dumbstruck. She was like, well, you know, do I not care about mental health? Yeah, I mean, I guess that's important. So she wanted to have a conversation about jobs. And through some hand-waving, we had a conversation about mental health. And luckily, I was there to say, nothing in what you just said has anything to do with this woman's concerns. You just admitted you can't solve those problems.
Mm. So does that really actually then suggest that there's a deflection going on, right? So we have fundamental social issues, right? And but we're actually trying to solve them by deflecting them into individual medical issues and then give somebody a pill and say, there you go, we've solved the problem, when we haven't really solved it at all. That's what you're, yeah?
It is, and that's what I call it in my research. I call it a deflection activity. Mm. But what's interesting is actually they don't want to give people pills. Right. That's actually often looked down on quite a lot because it's too easy. So, and if it's basically you're trusting that person to deal with the problem themselves. And there's a huge amount, there's a very big sort of theme within my research when I look at these discourses of having very little trust in everyday people to be able to manage their own psychology, to be able to manage their own lives without some kind of professional intervention. And this is fertile ground for this proliferation of experts of everyday life in all manner of living. There's no aspect of life too mundane for expertise. How we raise our children, what we eat, how we think about what we eat. There's even like, I did a study of mindfulness and it's like how to eat a raisin mindfully, you know, like there's nothing too mundane for this this colonization of expertise.
Right. So then it sounds to me as though we're moving almost like to an adult to a child relationship, right? It's almost like somebody over there knows what the solution is, and if you only listen to me, we could actually solve your problem for you. Is that a fair assumption?
Here's the interesting thing is that not only is it a deflection activity, but I've also noticed, so one of the things that I've been looking at in my research is the way that these discourses kind of give way to something new, because they make these huge promises, but they ultimately can't make good on them because they say, oh, we're going to solve like every social problem. You know, like so many people jump on the bandwagon of self-esteem or happiness or well-being or whatever, mindfulness. And they all start stretching this discourse to say it's going to do this and that. Well, if it solves everything, it's not going to, you know, it ultimately can't make good on these promises, right? And so the discourse kind of gives way to something new. And, you know, that old discourse, oh, that was really bad and silly. But this new one, this truly is the panacea. But what I've noticed is as time has gone on, the promises made actually have become far more pessimistic. So self-esteem promised to be a social vaccine. It was going to solve all these problems. Every problem is ultimately a problem of self-esteem. You know, why do people commit crimes? Because they, you know, they don't feel good enough, you know. And, you know, it's going to solve teenage pregnancy and all these sorts of things that they promised. And it was going to vaccinate young people from future problems. That obviously didn't happen. And then happiness emerged as this new discourse that was going to do all these things. But what's interesting is that I've noticed that the mental health discourse and the mindfulness discourse, which are more of recent iterations of this, are far more pessimistic. So there are certain mindfulness advocates like Jon Kabat-Zinn who do make the old kind of claim, this is a social vaccine, where he literally says, we will solve all problems at their heart, the mind. So like the individual mind is a source of everything that goes wrong. We just go and we change the way people think, feel and behave and we'll solve all problems. But of course, that's not where problems are rooted. They're not rooted in people's minds or incorrect psychology or bad behaviors. In fact, the more interesting question sociologically is why a behavior that is perfectly rational at the individual level adds up to something that is quite irrational at the aggregate level. But they can't see that, right? So they start with the individual and they build out from there, that all the problems start there. But they actually don't say that we're going to solve problems. We say we're going to give you the resilience because they don't believe people actually have resilience without them. We're going to build that resilience just to be able to get through life. So the subject that's put forward in these discussions is very passive. And it is very childlike. And it's very interesting because you can see this, the way that democracy has started to become denigrated quite a lot. And we no longer see those in power as our representatives, but rather as our parents. And that, and like Nicola Sturgeon, for instance, in Scotland has literally said she's like a mother. I did a show once where people were like in a little warm up debate, someone on the panel said, well, what are politicians for if not to set a good example for the rest of us? And everyone goes, oh, yes, clapping. I was looking around shocked. They're not our parents. They're supposed to be our representatives. And so there's no longer this faith in everyday people to be able to manage their own psychology and their lives and so on. And there's this pessimism now about actually that these interventions can solve problems. No, it's just to give people the resilience to be able to passively accept the way things are.
Mm. So who actually benefits them from this mode of operation? So there must be some winners as well as some losers.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's obviously with any kind of sociological analysis, it's complicated. There are no monocausal explanations for why these things happen. I think the political economy, the sort of underlying kind of politics and economics of this is very, very interesting. So I think there's probably something that I haven't looked into quite a lot. I've just begun a new project looking specifically at this sort of therapeutic entrepreneur, the person who sells all these services. And I'm kind of suspicious that there is this, that part of it is this shift from material to service, from like, you know, manufacturing to service industries. And there's just this huge number of psychology graduates and graduates with sort of limited practice qualifications who have nothing to do and they're kind of making a purpose for themselves. And, you know, that's obviously never going to explain something so huge like this. But I think some of the little bits of therapeutic entrepreneurship are fed by this just never ending output of all these sorts of graduates. But that's just a tiny little bit of it. The sort of bigger picture is we've lost sort of politics. Like there's no politician is going to say like, do this because the future is better, you know, follow me. And I've got the ideology that says it's going to work. I mean, you communists, you Christians, you libertarians, like nobody uses that language anymore. It's all the language of evidence, of so-called science that defers political responsibility to the science, quote-unquote scientific evidence. And so they never say, do this because God said so, do this because I think this is the best move to make. It says because the evidence says so. So there's this kind of symbiotic relationship that grows between policymakers who are bereft of ideology and these people who, you know, it's good for your career. It's good for people like me to be on TV and to do research that feeds into policy. You know, in the UK, we have the REF, the Research Excellence Framework. We have to show that your research has had an impact. And often there's this, what we call, you know, policy-based evidence that you, there's this policy that people have decided, you know, through claims making and so on, has become institutionalized. And they're like, okay, we need some evidence. We're like, I'll give you that evidence. You know, the funding calls that go out. And, you know, it once something becomes a paradigm, like well-being or whatever, it encourages people to frame their research in those terms. Like right now, everybody's sort of clamoring to frame their research. Well, they were for the last about 5 years, 10 years well-being. Now it's moved into mental health. So they're saying, oh, it's going to help mental health in some way. And so there's the sort of mechanics of how education and research works has fed into this a lot and encouraged this kind of pseudo expertise and pseudoscience. A lot of it is pseudoscience. A lot of it is just bad science. And it takes about 10 years to realize that it's bad science because you have to do, you know, it takes a long time to gather the evidence and to do large scale studies. But it's very interesting because at the very beginning of these claims making campaigns, they'll claim that it's a science as hard as nails, you know, self-esteem. The science says, of course, it emerged, you know, about a decade later after everyone had moved on to something else that it, you know, didn't do anything. In fact, it may have even been harmful.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, you know, players like Big Pharma also benefit? I'm just thinking of all the efforts going on at the moment. If I take COVID as an example, right? Mm-hmm. There are lots of pharma companies, you know, pushing particular solution sets, all of which, if they're successful, will make them lots of money.
Yeah, you can see this like in some contexts, particularly some national contexts, some countries in particular. So China, for example, has tended to push pharmaceuticals and more like psychiatrization of social issues. So, you know, if there, you know, when there's like a factory closes down, you know, through neoliberalization, you know, they're closing factories and that kind of thing. And the workers are obviously very discontent because they were promised a job, right? They had the right to work. And what that could be a very dangerous kind of thing, right? If these people band together, they could take over the factory, you know, they could start a very large movement, and they have done, and they do. And so one of the things that the Chinese government has done is, you know, they've become very, very interested in sort of therapeutic ideas. Even my own book has been translated into Chinese because I don't think anybody's actually read it. Because if they did, they'd realize. But they just like translating tons of self-help literature and so on, training people in various and sundry forms of therapeutic knowledge. Like, so you've got like therapist taxi drivers, therapist housemaids, these like cheap and expendable companions for middle-class ladies. And what they do is they individualize that discontent. So you have this very sad person, this bad thing's happened to you, we're very sorry about that. And this individual has this sickness, instead of it being like, well, the factory closed down and now you've got nothing in your life, right? And a whole bunch of other people are in the same situation. No. It's you. And these feelings that you have are an illness. So you can see that kind of happening. So the state benefits from that, obviously, and pharmaceutical companies benefit from that. I don't really look into the pharmaceutical side of it. Part of the reason why I don't do that is that it's outside the remit. So I'm very much looking at interventions, the sort of like mindfulness practitioners, the hypnotherapists, and that kind of thing. There's a lot of very good research that looks at the psychiatry side of it. But part of the reason why I never did was that it always seemed very conspiratorial, you know, like these big interests are pulling the strings when, yeah, they wouldn't have a market for pharmaceuticals if there wasn't a culture receptive to claims that your feelings are a kind of illness.
Mm. But you made one really, really important point there, which is that by individualizing it, you then don't get social action, right? You don't get groups of people saying, hang on, we've all got the same problem. There's something bigger that we should be doing to drive change, right? Mm-hmm. So it effectively compartmentalizes and individualizes all the issues, and it keeps people quiet.
To a certain extent, yes. It does. There is a form of anti-capitalism that I call a psychological critique of capitalism that says the main reason why capitalism is bad is that it makes people depressed or psychologically unwell. And I think that ultimately it also fails as a proper capitalist critique. You know, Karl Marx has a great quote where he says it's the kind of critique that knows how to judge and condemn the present but not how to understand it. And I think it really falls into that kind of critique because, you know, it says, well, the present is quite bad because it makes us unhappy. Well, we don't know why. And also, if it constructs people as very passive and quite likely to become sick as a result of circumstances, which is ahistorical because human beings have been through really bad things in the past and we didn't all become psychologically unwell. And in fact, human beings are pretty darn resilient. And it's also very disproportionate to the problem. So if the problem with capitalism is that it makes people psychologically unwell, not even everybody, which is the most amazing thing for such an exploitative system, you know, most people are actually doing pretty well. So the idea that you have to destroy the whole system and put something else in place because some people become psychologically unwell is incredibly disproportionate. And also, who's to say that what comes after isn't going to be equally, you know, painful to the fragile human psyche? And what about the process of revolution? Do you think that's all fairies and butterflies? Absolutely not. And so it posits this very deterministic idea of what it means to be human. Bad thing happens, we get sick. It's not like that. It depends very much on how you interpret the events. Many people throughout the world are able to get on in awful circumstances, and that's a testament to the human spirit. And actually, that is used as a reason to keep people in this bad situation too, which I would never say. But the problems with capitalism are much, much deeper than the fact that they make people feel bad. And also, if we're all just passive victims, well, the solution is medical. In fact, if that was the main problem with capitalism, I would actually support giving everybody drugs. Because why overturn an entire social system because of that, or an economic system because of that? I think the problems are economic there. And they are, to a certain extent, you know, it's you know, exploitation obviously has a part of feeling. There's a feeling of being of unfairness, right? But I think that the main problems are much deeper and endemic to the system.
Yeah, fine. Very interesting. And one other question I had was, clearly across society there will be a small proportion of people who have real mental issues and need real help, right? So because of the widespread application of this thinking to the broader community, do you think the ones that really need it potentially don't get the right help as a result of that?
Oh, absolutely. And we've actually seen that happen a lot of times. So what's happened with a lot of the claims making surrounding mental health is that this the intense focus on well-being, which was supposed to be about, you know, well, why have psychologists always focused on negatives? We should focus on what makes life well, go well. The reason why people focused on negatives was because they had the idea that once you got rid of problems, human beings could just get on with things, that they had the capacity to do that. The idea that you also have to focus on well-being and happiness and promote positive mental health says that without intervention, people are by nature sick or quite likely to become unwell, that we do not possess that capacity. And so what's that? What that's done is it's expanded the purview of expertise and intervention to everyone. So everybody could use this. And then services are like overwhelmed. And I've done some interviews with people in you know, various counseling services or what's now called well-being services. And they're like dumbfounded. They go, well, you know, I've got people coming to me because their dog died. And you know, and I just want to tell them, you don't need professional help because your dog died. That's part of life. But the thing is that we've told them that they do, that as a responsible citizen, you are supposed to get professional help. And like that, that everyday people don't have that capacity to deal with other people's problems. And so you get people just being absolute jerks to each other. And they think they're being progressive, like, oh, I'm not qualified to deal with your problems. You know, I'm not going to do that emotional labor. Like, what have human beings been doing for like tens of thousands of years, if not having giving other people a shoulder to cry on? Now we've said, oh no, that requires professional intervention. And so what we've done is we've expanded the well, it's great because it expands the market for all of these various and sundry kinds of interventions. And then and you can actually see at the beginning of campaigns, one of the very first things, the claims that is, one of the first claims that are made is that, you know, there's this hidden problem in society, and the and part of that problem is that people are trying to deal with it on their own. And so they say, no, 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 get professional help, get professional help. So with mindfulness, it was like, oh, we've got this wonderful thing and nobody's taking it up. So they have this big campaign to encourage uptake of mindfulness. Go to your GP and demand this, right? It's going to solve all these problems. So it works. The campaign works. GPs start recommending it. Then there's this huge demand for mindfulness. And they go, ah, see, the problems in society are so great. You can see this by the demand for mindfulness. But the you told people that they can't. And it's the same thing with counseling service in universities. They said, you know, the problem is that students are relying on each other. So no, no, go and demand services. So the students say, oh, okay. So they go and they demand services. And then we're like, what are you doing here? Like, and then they just over counseling services are overwhelmed, or well-being services are overwhelmed. And they say they see it as indicative of the scale of the problem. But actually, it may be indicative of the fact that you've told people with everyday issues that they are not equipped to deal with these things. And then people who really do have issues, who need like a mental health nurse, like a proper qualified professional, are not able to get it because the waiting list is enormous. So this is a humongous problem.
So how do you think we should go about addressing that problem then?
Ah, you want me solutions? No, all I do is diagnose. I think that part of the issue that we have in society is this construction of what it means to be human in very weak, fragile terms. And I think what happens is in each of these iterations of self-being, happiness, and well-being, and mental health promotion, so on, problem just gets deeper and deeper. And people will attack that particular iteration. So we have lots of critiques of mindfulness. There were lots of critiques of the happiness movement, lots of critiques of mental health promotion. And okay, in these things, they claim they're going to solve everything, and then they don't solve anything. They become exhausted. You can see the sort of, if you look at the number of times that well-being is mentioned, it gradually tapers off. But then something else grows out of it. So mental health becomes, people stop talking so much about well-being, or they keep saying well-being and mental health, and then the well-being drops away and they're just talking about mental health. Like I've actually quantified how this happens in newspapers. And then we're on to the next thing and we're criticizing that thing. And we're not asking, why does this keep happening? And the answer is because the underlying pressures and cultural forms are still there. They remain intact. And part of that is an economic, a deeper kind of economic base to this, that this is people's livelihood, right? So they're, you know, you've created all these spaces, the last fad created all these spaces and institutions, and these people will be hungry for the next fad, you know, self-esteem wanes and they're looking for the next thing. And so there's spaces and institutions, there are all these people who work in these services. There's this just enormous like army of professionals, right, who are just looking, who are like, whose job, they're like the social problems industry. It's their job to create problems and claim that they're going to have the solutions. So that's all still there. But it all thrives also on this fundamental idea of the human subject as very weak, very fragile, quite likely to become sick. And it's that that needs to be contested, I think, in addition to obviously the sort of deeper work of understanding capitalism and so on. But we need to make a space for human rationality and to say, actually, no, human beings can understand the world in a rational way. We do act rationally in our lives. The problems of the world are not down to our behaviors. And really make a case for a much more open understanding of the human subject. There's a very good book by Marshall Berman called All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. And he says, an open subject means an open future. And that what that means is that if what it means to be human is just dictated by nature, oh, you know, people say, it's just human nature. That, why do we have these problems? It's just human nature. Why do we have economic crisis? People are greedy, you know? Well, that's the way it's always going to be then. There's no point in trying to change the world because human nature will just express itself again. But if you look throughout history and across the world, you see many, many different ways of organizing human societies, many, many different reactions to circumstances, many, many different ways of finding happiness. Like, and, you know, like, think about ancient Greece, you know, what was conducive to happiness was like fundamentally different, even though people will take Aristotle as like the understanding of happiness forever. But the base of society is different, and therefore what it means to be human is different. And that means that the future can be different, and that human beings will be different and are different in different contexts. And that's very important because it means that the way things are is not a result of human nature. We can change things. And if we understand the world, then we can change it.
Ashley, I really appreciate your time today. I think that's a very inspiring and very powerful message. And thank you very much for sharing your insights with DFA. I wish you well on your research, and I shall be watching with interest how it develops, because it's a really fascinating area.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.